You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. In the year 2000, Kosovo was still reeling from a brutal war. Soldiers from over a dozen different countries patrolled the region's towns and villages as part of a NATO peacekeeping mission. NGOs scrambled to help rebuild the country. Severin Otteser had just finished grad school and knew very little about any of it.
I was 22, and I got my first job as assistant country director for Médecins du Monde, Doctors of the World in Kosovo. So I didn't speak Albanian, I didn't speak Serbo-Croatian, I had absolutely no knowledge of Kosovo history, politics, culture. I think I actually started reading my first book about the Balkan on the flight there. And I never finished the book because the flight was coming from Paris, so it was way too short for a book. But the reason I got the job is because by the standard of the standard peace-building agencies, I was extremely qualified for my job.
She says she spoke halfway decent English and had master's degrees from prestigious universities in both France and the U.S. NGOs respected that, according to Otteser. The fact that she knew nothing about Kosovo didn't seem to bother them. Otteser spent the next 6 months documenting human rights abuses, advocating for Kosovo's ethnic minorities, and managing Médecins du Monde's mission to the region.
Well, after that, I realized that no, I knew nothing. I knew nothing, and I wasted a lot of people's time because I was trying to do my best, but I had no idea what I was doing. And sadly, I'm not the only one, and many of my friends who work in international aid have had the same issue, the same situation, and they have realized the same thing.
Today, Otteser is a professor of political science at Barnard College. She spent decades working in international aid in war-torn countries, from Afghanistan to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and she's deeply skeptical of the international peacekeeping community. She argues that peace-building doesn't require billions of dollars in aid or massive international interventions. The first step is following the lead of local communities. Otteser cites countless examples in her latest book, The Front Lines of Peace, An Insider's Guide to Changing the World. Severin Otteser, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad your goals were so modest. An Insider's Guide to Changing the World. Nothing bigger than that. Paradox is embedded in there. By definition, the people in a conflict zone have very opposed views of who should be in charge, how a place should be run, who gets the resources. How do you put them in charge of the solution without ending up in pretty much the same situation that demanded an emergency response in the first place?
Well, the first thing is that you take your time. Instead of trying to arrive and think, okay, we have 2 days, we're going to define the problem, define the solution, and implement everything, you actually breathe and you ask people what they think. And that's what I show works in conflict zones. I have stories from Congo to Somalia, etc., etc. And you remember that these stories, they're all long stories, stories that take months or years just to find an agreement, but then the agreements actually work.
Does the situation, though, sometimes force you to do anything but take a breath?
There are two answers to your question, Ray. The first one is that first, when you ask people on the ground, when I talk to people in Congo, in Afghanistan, etc., they keep telling the same thing to me and to other researchers, which is stop intervening right away and making things worse. They tell us, please think before acting so that you don't make my situation worse. And that I respect. I hate it when people come to me and they pretend that they're going to resolve my own problems and then they make things 10 times worse. So that's the first thing. It's a request from people who live in conflict zone. The other part of the answer is that what you're mentioning is what I call something that calls for a humanitarian aid response. when you talk about refugee camp, about people starving, about people dying, whether we're talking about the emergency in Congo after the Rwandan invasion in the 90s, or the current emergency in Myanmar, or in many other parts of the world, or in Ethiopia, this is what calls for an emergency response, for a humanitarian response, bringing food, bringing blankets, making sure that people don't starve to death, don't freeze to death. That's really important, but that's different from building peace. What you're talking about is addressing the consequences of violence. What I'm talking about is addressing the causes of violence. And to address the causes of violence, again, we need to really make sure that we address the right causes so that we don't make the situation worse.
That's kind of the difference between somebody getting preventive medical care and ending up in an emergency room. But we don't seem to be set up as a world for that, are we?
No, we're not. And that's why I wrote this book, is because whenever I look at the common way to build peace, I see a lot of errors. And again, I've worked on peace building for 20, 25 years now. And for the first part of my career, all I saw were elite agreements, handshakes between presidents, the big conference here in New York or in Addis Ababa. And I focused on that. And I thought, well, this is how we build peace. And I also thought that I would be a diplomat one day and I would interact with presidents and governments. And that way I would build peace. And then I realized that these people don't really have an impact on the ground, because peace agreements are signed and then violence continues on the ground. And we've seen that over and over and over again. When I've started looking at what works in building peace in conflict zones, what works is the kind of bottom-up local initiatives that I describe in the book and that we were talking about.
In the peacemaking, peacekeeping assignments, we tend to break the problem down into component parts. If you talk to the people who do this work, they will tell you similar stories about the places where they've done their work, because the problems seem the same to them. Why is local knowledge so important when the challenges of getting people help are not that different in some of these circumstances?
Okay, so if you want to talk about humanitarian aid, I'm going to call my husband, who's in the next room, and he's going to talk about his work. But if you want to talk about peace building, again, that's the difference. Yes, and yes, if you're talking about bringing water supply or bringing education, you have to start from the grassroots, because it is much more effective. Because it's only the communities who know exactly, okay, why don't they get the water supply? Why have all of the projects before failed? All of these things require local knowledge. And that's just for what I call humanitarian aid. But now let's move on to peace building. If I take your question and I apply it to peace, to the causes of violence, what you're telling me is violence is violence. Violence that we see in the street of New York, where I am right now, is the same as violence that we see in Congo, which is the same as violence we see in Afghanistan. So, of course, yes, there are similarities, both in the causes and in the consequences, but anybody who has been in a war situation, and I'm sure you will agree with me, that the causes of violence are not the same, whether you're talking about Afghanistan or Congo. And even more importantly, when you're talking about one country and you go down to the level of the village, the reason why people are fighting in one village are going to be different from the reason why people are fighting in another village. Every time you try to talk to people in conflict zones, you realize that the reasons why they are fighting are incredibly different. And therefore, you cannot have this standard approach that's designed in New York or in Geneva or in Washington, D.C. and think, okay, this is how I'm going to resolve everybody's problem in the entire country. It's just not going to work. And it doesn't work.
One thing that you come back to again and again in the book is what you call Peace Incorporated, Peace Inc. What did you observe? What is it?
So Peace Inc. is the traditional approach to building peace. It's an approach that's based on a lot of misleading assumptions. For example, the idea that only outsiders have the skills and the expertise to build peace. And that's how I ended up in Kosovo, although I knew nothing about Kosovo. It's also this idea that only top-down intervention, so working with elites, with presidents, with governments, with rebel leaders, this is the only way to end violence. And also the idea that all good things come together. So we can promote peace and democracy and justice and human rights as a package deal, and everything is going to work. And so, yes, I show in the book that in an ideal world, it would be wonderful, but unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world. And therefore, this peace ink strategy is really, really wrong. It doesn't help end violence, and often it actually makes the situation worse.
Can you give us some examples of places where you saw solvable problems that weren't getting solved because Peace Inc. had landed and they were doing what they normally do?
Okay, I'll tell you a very, very simple story. So it was a very long time ago, 2004 in Congo. Rebels took over the city of Bukavu, where I was staying. And so for several days, we had bomb flyings. We had the rebel soldiers who took over the city, and they started raping a lot of people, killing a lot of people, looting a lot of houses. It was really a terrible, terrible time. And at a point, there was a little boy and his mother, and they saw several soldiers enter the house just next to theirs. And they heard their neighbor shout and scream. It was obvious that their neighbor was about to be raped. So the little boy ran for help, and he ran for help. He ran to one of the peacekeeping bases that was just next to their home. And when he arrived, Peace Inc. was there. Peace Inc. was represented by a sentry on duty who was a Uruguayan soldier who didn't speak Swahili and didn't speak French, so didn't speak any of the local languages spoken in Congo. So, okay, the boy uses body language. You know, the role of the peacekeeping mission at the time was to protect the local population. It was a time of crisis. It was a time of war, of rape. So the little boy tried to communicate what was happening using body language. And then at a point, the sentry made a sign that, yes, okay, I got it. Wait, just wait a few minutes. He went inside the base, and he came back a few minutes later with a pack of cookies that he gave to the boy. Cookies. So not only the guy didn't speak Swahili or French, but also he had so little understanding of the situation that he didn't realize that when someone was asking for something in the middle of looting, raping, and bombing, it was for protection. It was not for cookies. And to me, that really exemplifies a lot of the problems with Peace Inc. I have a lot of other stories like that in the book. So,
well, how could that particular example, how should that have been otherwise?
Well, you can send people who with a better training. I mean, first you can send people who speak at least some of the local languages. If they don't speak the local languages, they should have the time to learn the local languages before going there. The Peace Corps, for instance, has a 6-month training program in which people learn local languages before going into their next posting. So learning local languages, having actual briefing about what the situation is like, what are the problems, what people want. Because usually when peacekeepers are trained, they get a 2 weeks training, and a lot of it is based on bureaucratic stuff. How do you fill out the report? How do you request R&R, you know, rest and relaxation? How you get your a house that a place to stay that will be approved by the security services? You know, all of the stuff that are very logistic, but that don't help you do your job better. They are just bureaucratic things. And my friends who work for the United Nations and for NGOs, for non-governmental organizations, they often tell me that when they arrive, they know extremely, extremely little about the situations that they want to change and that they're here to help. And they have to learn on the job. And learning on the job, well, it means that very often they're going to make mistakes.
You can understand why this happens, though. There's a sort of momentum that has built up in this world because we've seen what happens when the international response is slow. Rwanda's a good example. The world waited 6 weeks, and in those 6 weeks, more than 800,000 people were killed. Not necessarily the most learned response, not necessarily the most prepared response, but the idea now is we can't just sit around and wait. We've got to jump in there right away. And that probably contributes to the situation you're talking about.
It does, and we could spend 1 hour, 2 hours, we could spend the entire day talking about these problems. But the important point to keep in mind is that there is another way to build peace. There is another way to build peace that actually works, that doesn't make the situation worse, and that promotes an actual end to the fighting and an actual end to the violence on the ground.
What does that look like?
It looks like first, a very low profile from outsiders, from people like you and I, a very backseat approach to peace building. It looks like people who don't arrive and think that they know better, they know the problems and they're going to implement the solutions right away, but rather people who listen to local populations and who are open-minded, who understand that other people have a different understanding of peace and democracy and development. So, for instance, there is one organization that I really like that's called the Life and Peace Institute, and that's exactly how they work. When they recruit people to send to conflict zones, they try to find people who already have a knowledge of that conflict zones. When these people arrive on the ground, they're in it for the long run. They stay on site for years, sometimes close to a decade. And they don't try to hang out in the expat circles, in the circles of international aid workers that you and I know so well. But they try to hang out with local populations. They try to develop local networks and to have friends among the communities that they're working with. And it's an approach that takes time. So it's an approach where, for instance, when they want to resolve a problem, they're going to invite everybody to tell them, okay, what is the problem? Why are you fighting? And then they will realize sometimes that the problem that they thought they were addressing was actually not the real issues and the real reasons for the fighting.
I'm wondering if, for all the wisdom encapsulated in what you've just been talking about, whether in some places the problems are so unavoidable and so huge that even this patient longitudinal response isn't going to be enough. When you go somewhere else in search of resources, there's usually somebody already there. Will there be, in the world we're looking at for the next couple of decades, more resource-based conflict that's going to be hard to solve in part because we can't create new world for ourselves? There's not any more land being created anywhere.
Well, resource-based conflict have been there for decades, for centuries. It's not something new. And yes, climate change is making things worse in certain parts of the world and different, but it doesn't mean that the solutions that we have found to resolve violence are not going to work anymore. So take Somalia and Somaliland. Somalia and Somaliland are really affected by climate change and by all of the problems that we were describing. But the interesting thing is when you compare, so if you see a map of Africa, you have Somaliland, that's an autonomous region in the north of Somalia. And you know that Somalia is extremely violent. It has some of the highest ranking in the world's least desirable category, you know, most corrupt countries, second most failed state, extremely violent. Every day I read news about a new bombing, a new terror attack, a new massacre in Somalia. So that's Somalia. And then in the north, you have this autonomous region called Somaliland. And Somaliland went through a very bloody independence war with Somalia in the late 1980s and in the 1990s. But Somaliland for the past 20 years has been has experienced very little violence, very, very little terrorism. It has a well-functioning state. It has decent public services. It even has some kind of functioning democracy. And what's absolutely fascinating about Somaliland is that when you look at why it works, so of course there are many reasons for the difference, but you see that the usual Peace Inc. approach prevailed in Somalia, while in Somaliland, Peace Inc. didn't run the show. In Somaliland, the peace was built from the bottom up. It was built by the communities, by ordinary people, by teachers, by local businessmen, by farmers, by herders, by all of the populations together. And they found ways to build peace, not only on a very small scale, not only in their little village, but also if you look at Somaliland, it's actually quite a large territory. I think it's bigger than Syria. So to me, it's a fascinating, fascinating place of the world because we can learn so much from them in terms of what works to build peace during and after mass violence.
And let me just point out for our listeners that Somalia is the internationally recognized country and internationally recognized government, and very, very few places in the world recognize the existence of an entity called Somaliland, even though, as the professor points out, that's the place that's running properly with decent water and sanitation and protection for the daily life of its citizens. But if you look at a map of the world, it's a totally imaginary state. It doesn't really exist in the way that we think of states existing. If they turned up at the UN and said, here we are, the delegation from Somaliland, nobody would seat them and nobody would recognize their credentials.
And to me, that's what's really interesting, because that links back to what we were talking about. The fact that diplomats, when they want to build peace in Somalia, they're going to interact with the warlords who are based in Mogadishu, in the capital of Somalia. And they're not going to interact with the people who actually run the show on the ground in Somaliland and who have the power and who have the knowledge to build peace.
Is it too cynical to wonder if Peace Inc. is never really meant to end the need for itself? If it's an industry, maybe its interests are in keeping itself going and not putting itself out of business. There are UN agencies that are set up in part to supply the needs and speak to the interests of Palestinian refugee camps that were set up after the 1948 war.
I've heard this question quite a few times, and to me, it sounds too much like a conspiracy theory. And I don't think this is accurate, because when you talk to people who work for these agencies, at UNRWA, the agency set up to help Palestinian refugees, or who work for any other parts of the United Nations system, or even for many diplomats who work in conflict zones, people come in with the best of intentions very often. So yes, they have their own interests, they want their comfortable lives, etc. But they also really believe that they will help local populations on the ground, and that they are doing something good. And some of them make enormous sacrifices. I'm sure you know a lot of aid workers who have sacrificed their family life. They don't see their wives and children and husbands and loved ones and parents for years. They miss their children growing up. They miss everything about their country. And they go to places so that they can help perfect strangers, because they think that they are doing the right thing and they think they can help. And to me, that's why it's so important that we get our peace building strategies better. Because when we have people who are smart, who are devoted, who are dedicated, who really want to do the right thing, we need to give them the tools to do the right thing instead of preventing them from doing their job. And that's why, again, I think we really need to change the way we go about building peace. So the way peace actually looks like when it's done properly is by first involving everybody in the definition of the problem. So you remember this organization I was telling you about, Life and Peace Institute, when they want to resolve a conflict, they invite everybody that matters. So they talk to politicians, but also to farmers, to women's groups, to ordinary people, to militia commanders, soldiers, rebel leaders, everybody who may have a stake in the conflict. And then they spend time just trying to make sure that everybody agrees on a definition of the problem.
Would multinational organizations, NGOs, international agencies, Peace Inc., really have to re-engineer themselves, bring on board different skill sets, really change how they do what they do to take on your model in a conflict zone?
They would. And that's probably one of the reasons why I'm not super popular at the United Nations headquarters or within some foreign affairs ministry. It's because they would have to change their routines. They would have to hire new people. So yes, we still need to have experts in gender, election organization, human rights, military experts, etc. But also we need to have experts in local conflict. We need to have people who understand about local conflict resolution. And we need to have country experts and people who know a lot about the country where they're going to be working, or about the, even better, about the province, about the village. And the way of going about their job is also going to be different. It's not going to be based in capital cities and headquarters too much anymore. It's going to be a lot of going to rural areas and spending time with people and listening to ordinary people rather than thinking that you know better and that you have the solution and that you're bringing the solutions to people's problem. Like it's a complete change of mentality. You don't know better, but the people who are experiencing the conflict can tell you what they need. And then you need to think about how you can provide what they need. It's very different and it's not easy for them to change, but it's possible because, again, I've seen a lot of success stories and I've seen people do that. So we know it's possible.
How has your book been received by people who run Peace Inc., UN and multinational NGOs?
The book is just out. So far, I don't know. I don't even know if they've heard of it or if I think they have.
But this isn't the first time you've said things like this, though. I mean, I'm sure there are people who are aware of your skepticism about the way we've been doing things so far.
Oh, okay. So for that, there are usually three different kinds of reactions by the leaders of Peace Inc. The first one is a lot of people get really angry at me and really upset and very defensive and say that they're doing wonderful things and how dare I criticize their work. While to me, I'm not criticizing, I'm trying to help them be better. But I understand people being angry, and that's completely fine. The other interesting thing is, oh, I completely agree with everything that you're saying. You're describing the other one so well.
Not the place I work. Right.
No, not mine. No. You're describing, so the peacekeeper tell me, you describe the diplomats so well. The diplomats tell me, you describe the United Nations so well. Or you describe the NGO. I mean, everybody think that I describe the other one very well. And the other one really has to change and to do what I tell them to do.
Well, I've known many of these people. You've mentioned that you're married to one. They're compassionate, they're brave, they're resourceful, they're knowledgeable, they're tremendously useful. Is the problem that we're just using them incorrectly?
I think that the problem is that when we're sending them to conflict zones, we give them the wrong strategy, the wrong approach, and the wrong way of going about the situation. And I know because we train at Colombia, at SIPA, we train a lot of these people. And very often when they arrive in my class and they start talking about bottom-up peace building, they're like, oh, I never thought about that, but I like it. So they're not exposed to this kind of thinking. So we train them in a way, let's, you know, go and build peace from the top down. And you, after a master's degree, you're going to have the answer. You're going to have the solution. You're going to be the big shot. And I think we do them a disservice because when they arrive on the ground, they realize that their work is not what they thought it would be and that their effectiveness is not what they wished it would be. And very often then they try to change the situation from the inside, but it's really hard for them to do that. So I think that the number of people who are trying to change the situation from the inside, to rely on insiders, to use the strategies that work, this number of people is growing and it's growing. And eventually I really hope that they're going to manage to change the situation and we're going to have the better peace building strategies, the ones that I've seen at work in conflict zone and that really, really manage to decrease violence.
Very quickly before we go, is it important to have multiple models of success, to say, to point to and say, look, this is the other way of doing it. This is where it's worked.
Yes, yes. And that's why I've been in conflict zones all over the world. I've tried to hit the different continents. I've tried to have rich country, poor countries, different religions, different stage of development, because I want to show that this is possible everywhere. And it's even possible at home in our own communities, because that way we can all learn something and not apply it directly, not use a template, but use these ideas so that we can help improve things around us. And it really, really makes a difference.
Séverine Autessert's new book is The Front Lines of Peace, an insider's guide to changing the world. Thanks a lot, Séverine, for the conversation.
Thank you so much, Ray, for having me. And thank you for listening.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG and First Republic Bank, and from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, Teresa Katsourilis, and Elise Manukian. Tatum Sanderbeck and Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Young. Thank you for listening.